Wissen. Handeln. Der Podcast zur engagierten Wissenschaft.
Welcome to the podcast on science and activism run by die Junge Akademie, the German Young Academy. How can researchers best engage with society and influence policy? Are they perhaps even ought to be active beyond academic discourse? And what are the dangers of and problems with such advocacy? We tackle these questions in a series of interviews under the tagline Wissen, Handeln, which you could translate to English as Knowledge, Action, a podcast on science and activism. This podcast is run by the working group Engagierte Wissenschaft of die Junge Akademie, which addresses science and activism. My name is Gisela Kopp. I am a member of die Junge Akademie based at the University of Konstanz in southern Germany, and I am a biologist with a focus on behavioral and evolutionary biology and genomics.
And I'm Doris Segertz. I'm also a member of die Junge Akademie and heading the chair on particle science and technology at the University of Duisburg-Essen. Today, we are really delighted to speak with Nicole Grobert, professor of nanomaterials at the University of Oxford and chair of the European Commission's Group of Chief Scientific Advisors. So Nicole studied chemistry at Ulm University, so did her chemistry studies in Germany, then worked with Nobel Prize laureate Sir Harry Kroto and received her PhD in physical chemistry from the University of Sussex in 2001. She was awarded with numerous prizes and is a permanent professor in the Department of Materials at the University of Oxford since 2010. She is a fellow of the Corpus Christi College, Oxford, and a visiting professor at Toyo University in Japan. So, Nicole, a warm welcome from Gisela and myself, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. Professor Grobert is the first chemist in our podcast, and we are especially interested in talking to her about three topics: the transfer of research, and what are you doing in particular in science, her engagement in multiple scientific policy advice structures, and if this can be regarded as kind of activism. So that's maybe a question what we can hopefully answer at the end of this podcast, and the variation among different disciplines and different national systems in how scientists get engaged. So now, first, regarding your personal motivation or coming to your science, for me, as a researcher dealing with nanoparticle technology, I'm always struggling when I try to explain what I do and why this is useful in a nutshell. So now, regarding your scientific activities, did you face similar issues or still do, maybe? And can you describe what you're doing in research in 2 to 3 sentences?
Hi, Doris, and hi, Gisela. Thank you very much for inviting me here today to have a little chit-chat about research, but also research and other activities that are related to research, and the whole bandwidth, really, of activities that I've been engaging with over a number of years now. Your question regarding the research that I'm interested in, so I kicked off my research in the area of nanomaterials, and more specifically understanding the formation of carbon nanotubes in the late 90s. It's been a buzzing field. What started with only a handful of scientists has now several thousands, if not millions, of researchers in the area of nanomaterials. Zero-dimensional, one- or two-dimensional nanomaterials, in which you're also working yourself. What are my interests? My interests are related to understanding how materials form, especially nanomaterials, how the synthesis itself affects the properties of these nanomaterials, the parameters that can be manipulated in order to influence the material's properties. So this structure property relationships at the nanometer scale. That's how I started. That's still what drives me, what drives my curiosity. The research that I do is curiosity driven. Yet with the pressure that most scientists experience in the sense, oh, what's the impact of your research and why are you doing this and what is it good for? You need to find answers, and you said yourself that you struggle to find these answers. And sometimes there are no answers. Sometimes you just do discovery-led research just to find out how things work, not necessarily to use these materials or to work on applications. So going across the TRL levels, or the TRL levels, I mean the basic research, right from the fundamental understanding all the way up to the applied research and end user applications, you need different skill sets on addressing this research across the length scales, and it can't be done by just one person. Nevertheless, we use, or fundamental research scientists use, public funds. The tax money is paying for research, and we've got quite a lot of freedom to use this money in order to do our research. So I think it only is a right thing to do to try, at least try and explain to the broader public or policymakers of what you do with this money and why it's important. Even if it isn't directly applicable to an application, but if you can't explain what you work on, how can other people understand what you do?
Maybe one private question, and then we will come to the activism part of this podcast. When crossing these TRLs, so these technology readiness levels, I think it's a huge challenge to overcome different TRL levels and to really push innovation into applications. So from your experience, what is the biggest challenge here?
There are many. Actually, probably this challenge is reflected in my career. I was always interested in the fundamental understanding of materials and concepts and just looking at these beautiful structures. It's just pretty to look at them and study them. But these questions that you mentioned earlier, what is it good for? Why are you doing it? And what's the application? And why on earth are you working on it? Drove me more and more into looking at the higher TRL levels. After my PhD, I applied for a number of fellowships and a European research grant, the European Research Council starting grant, proof of concept. And it was going higher and higher, the TRL levels, even though it's still quite low. But proof of concept is already looking into applications of the science that one develops in a Blue Skies research grant. And then more recently, I got the Royal Society Industry Fellowship, which allowed me to spend about 50% of my time at an industry partner, Williams Advanced Engineering, literally experiencing the people in industry trying to solve problems or challenges that are associated with that industry sector. And whilst it took us some time to communicate and understand each other where, in terms of our beliefs and concepts and solutions, on paper, that exercise then was fairly easy, but translating the know-how that you develop in a research laboratory at the university, there's a huge gap between this university-level research to taking it to the next level, basically bridging the R&D sector. And the question here is, who does that work? Industry won't do it unless they get a net benefit from it, because they would have to start some investment to get the work going without knowing whether it's really working. Academia can't necessarily do it because publish or perish. And if you work on a topic that is not new, but it has been mentioned somewhere, then it's hard to publish that paper. So that's where this big gap is. And who does the R&D work? Is it the industry partner? Doubtful. Academia can't do it because they need to teach, they need to apply for research funding, they need to publish the papers, they need to do a lot more, but can't do proper R&D work in the sense that it becomes useful for an industry partner. And in particular for nanomaterials is even more challenging, because a lot of the existing material systems in the macro scale already do the job quite well. And nanomaterials, even if in theory they would outperform macroscopic materials, the scalability of these systems is an issue. And who does the scaling up if they don't know whether it will be useful at the end for the application?
Yeah, thank you, not Nicole. I find it really impressive how you are engaged. Not only, I mean, now you talked a lot about like your transfer of your research to applicability, but you before also talked about your outreach activities and policy advice. But you didn't only do this, but you also were active in building up the structures for these policy advice, for example. So you were a founding member of the Young Academy of Europe, and you also contribute to S4D4C, so using science for diplomacy for addressing global challenges. You have been active in all these like very different fields. Do you see fundamental differences between these different fields? I mean, of course, they go into very different directions, but is there one that is most important to you that would maybe add to your self-description as a researcher so that you don't only see you as a scientist, but maybe also something more? And what would that be?
The overarching linker between all these topics is my curiosity and trying to make things work or find solutions to make them work. And whether that's related to research or maybe creating a better environment or an infrastructure that helps young researchers to have a voice in European policymaking, I think that that is then not so important. Nevertheless, the thing that energizes me the absolute most is when I'm in the lab, especially also talking to my group and the students, when they produce an image or a spectrum that is just really exciting. At the end of the day, I feel the very best if I spend doing that instead of hours in meetings and doing more of the paper pushing exercises. Now, you mentioned the diplomacy work. I wasn't really involved with that very much. I was kindly invited to give a presentation in my role as a member of the group of chief scientific advisors. So please don't attribute that to me. That is the work of other people who do a brilliant job there.
I just wanted to maybe, because for me, the concept of science diplomacy is rather novel. Could you maybe elaborate a bit on what that is or what it's meant to be and be good for?
So you probably experienced yourself that when you go to conferences and you meet other scientists, it's pretty much irrelevant where they come from because you have this common interest. So science doesn't really know borders. And science diplomacy uses this fact that science doesn't know borders to approach scientists in countries where maybe the political relationships are not that easy. And through the route of science and answering scientific questions or finding scientific solutions to find diplomatic ways of engaging with these countries. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that's so what comes now to my mind, you mentioned now so many different things. So publish or perish, a kind of credo that on the other hand withstands and following innovations and really push them to industry, because at a certain level you might not get so many credits for what you're doing. Then as scientists, we can talk to people from everywhere and always find a kind of a joint platform. On the other hand, at least three of us, rather likely just, and in particular you, want to go to the lab and talk to our doctoral students about results. Is this really possible, just talking about results, or was this also kind of a development where you started to realize maybe you cannot only stay in the lab and discuss results, but there is kind of engagement in committees, in politics, what you simply cannot avoid if you want to generate impact, true impact?
Yeah, so all my actions, I shouldn't say this here, but my actions are not necessarily driven by ticking the boxes, but my actions are driven by shaping the environment for my own research, but also for my research group. And I'd like to start at the point when I started university. So at school, I had maths and arts as A-levels, main subjects, although I was always keen to go into the sciences, physics, chemistry, biology were the key subjects that I was interested in at school. But as most of us know, it is quite dependent on the teacher and how inspiring the teacher is. So early on, I was facing a big disappointment that these subjects, which sounded so exciting, weren't as exciting as I was hoping they were. So here I was finishing my A-levels, not really having engaged much with the science subjects. And that's why I studied chemistry. I knew I liked using my hands through the art classes. I liked to cook, and I was still interested in science. And to me, chemistry was the obvious choice because you could do both. You could do the manual work, but you could also enter science. And so one thing led to the next, because when you do your undergraduate studies, you have very sort of formal structures in terms of which lectures you need to attend and which classes you need to do and which laboratory experiments. And at least that experience was that you weren't free to explore and do research. And that's when I started looking around for possible placements. And doing a placement in Germany would have been one option. But at the same time, I felt, if I do stay in research, I should work on my languages. French was something that I didn't succeed to learn at school. And the first choice was to contact French laboratories and say, could I work over the summer, maybe sweep the floors in the laboratory just to pick up what you do in the lab, but also the language. At the time, it wasn't possible because of health and safety reasons. You needed to be able to speak the language and so on and so forth. And in discussion with my family, it became transparent that my English wasn't as well developed as it probably should have been. So the idea was try the UK. And the UK was extremely welcoming in hosting summer students. So this was way before email was very popular. And I started a placement there. So one thing led to the next. I was basically, I guess I'm opportunity driven. So I was learning English. I was exposed to front research. I was right at the front of research that was going on in nanomaterials at the time when I joined Harry Korto's lab. And this is where I experienced the freedom of doing research during the summer, of course, with the supervision and so on and so forth. Entered my PhD and I had some more freedom, yet the supervisor was telling you, maybe you should try this and you should try something else. And I was eager to free myself to do my own research. Got the first postdoc and that was a bit more independence. And from the postdoc, you then start to ask yourself, should I stay in science or should I go elsewhere? And science was the answer for me. So I needed more independence. Then you apply for fellowships, you get your independent post that is not tenured, and you think, oh great, now I can go to the lab and do all this fantastic work that I am planning to do, but I don't have enough time, I need people. And then you start getting the first PhD student, the first postdoc, and you start to manage people, and you're actually removing yourself more and more from the physical lab work. And this is when I encountered peers of my age group who had also received funding from the European Research Council, when you suddenly lump with big sum of money and you have this responsibility. You don't have a permanent job, you have a lot of money, you have a lot of responsibility. And there were 11 of us who talked about this. We happened to meet in Paris, and this is when the idea of the Young Academy of Europe started. This concept of, you know, talking to each other, learning from each other how to handle different situations. Each scientists had experienced a different situation because they were based in France, in Spain, in Germany, in the UK. And the rules and regulations for supervising PhD students are very different in these countries, at least at the time. Now it may be a bit more similar, I'm not sure. So you can see how from this drive and urge and wanting to be free to do basic research, I ended up in a situation with a group of people starting the Young Academy of Europe, which basically is now a network of almost 300 members that support each other and that also can raise their voice in order to shape Europe and hopefully make it a better place. And so, it's, like I said, it's not a tick box exercise, but it's opportunity driven, the way I do things or have done things. And that included not only basic research, but also the policy making aspect and building platforms. And if you want to call it activism, then call it activism. I wouldn't give it a name.
Yeah, but some people don't like to be called activists. So and especially natural sciences have this self-perception of being really neutral. Everything is just the science. There's nothing political about it. So, and they would maybe distance themselves from being called an activist. So that was where my question was motivated.
I have no strong feelings about it, but I wouldn't call myself an activist. I would call myself a person who was, like I said before, opportunity driven, aiming for creating an environment that everyone enjoys to be working in and to better our lives in a way, whether it is through research or through networking or just collaboration.
Have you also, from these experiences you had in these different other circles, have you had repercussions of this engagement on your research? So did your research change in response to how you were engaged beyond your core research?
In the context of the Young Academy of Europe, it hasn't changed, except that sometimes I felt, I'm spending a bit too much time on outside the lab. What has changed is that I have opened up to listening to, I shouldn't say applied science, but to look at the end user needs, to listen to what industry has to say, what their needs are. And when we then conduct our fundamental and basic research, that we do that with an end user application in mind, not that we work on the application, but that we have some awareness of what's happening in the world and what may need to be addressed. So still do blue skies discovery-led research, but not completely in isolation.
When listening to you, so this week I met a colleague via Zoom, a female colleague from engineering, from the field of control, and I'm from chemical engineering. And she said to me, Doris, look, I always wanted to do my research. But now, the more I grow up and get more and more established, I see that there's no way out. And I'm always the only female in the room. And I have no real choice. So either I can leave or accept things like they are, or try to restructure things around myself that I can do my research inside them. So this is something where she told me, I have no choice. I need to do that. Did you make similar experiences?
Women in nano and diversity, is that what you're referring to? So these two projects. The two European projects that were driven by the IFW in Dresden, and Mariana Kalin was particularly in charge of these projects. And I inherited the participation in Women in Nano. That was my first encounter with actively contributing to this topic. That was when I first joined Oxford. A colleague of mine, Amanda Petford-Long, she was formerly a partner in that network, but then moved to the US and handed over that project to me. And it was, it was the first year and a half or so, I was basically ignoring it because I didn't know what to do with it. I just wanted to be in the lab. And until the PI contacted me and I said, look, either you take some action or you're out and you have to return the funds. In a panic, I said, okay, better do something about this. And there was a workshop that was organized in, I think it was organized in Ljubljana by Spomenka Kobe. And it was the first time that I was in this room with the members of the consortium and about 100 female PhD students, master students. And it was an environment that I hadn't experienced before, because normally it's men and a couple of women. And it had a certain dynamic, it had a certain energy. And when I spoke to these women and sort of exchanged thoughts with them, and when I saw them react to a speaker who was presenting at the time with questions and the confidence that they were bringing, it was quite striking. It was a striking experience in the sense that personally, I never bother whether it's a woman, a man, or something in between, whoever on the spectrum, because I look at the human being behind it. But for some women, or also men, or other people, it's important to have these role models, and it's important for them to get the energy and the courage to step up and speak out. And I hadn't realized that until the point I met these 100 PhD students. And from that point, I started to be more active, and we had great fun with this project. There are lots of these PhD students who are now either in a research-related position or in academia. And from this project, it led to the next, diversity, where the leadership was addressed, leadership in the sense that you have more parity in committees and leadership positions. That was the last project I was formally engaged with, but on a day-to-day basis, I think I contribute by just engaging and talking to women scientists or whoever is asking for advice. At the same time, the first thing I say, you know, the best advice is not to listen to advice, but follow your gut instinct. But if you can have this person to exchange with, and maybe in a less public situation, ask questions that could help individuals to just overcome this little fear when you wonder, am I really good enough to do this? Yes, of course you are.
Maybe going in the similar direction, and you already said that your group is very diverse. You also have people from very different disciplines in your group, from different cultural backgrounds. When you advise, maybe you already said people shouldn't listen to advice, but I would assume that you are often asked for advice. So do you advise them exactly the same, or do you think there are different, maybe specific risks one should be aware of, or would you give different advice to different groups of people? For example, related to how one should engage in policy advice or how one should engage with industry. Do you think there are specific risks to different groups of people?
I haven't thought about this specifically, so I wouldn't be able to give you an answer straight away, but I can tell you what I normally do when people contact me, and that is I usually ask them to assess their situation, to explain to me where they see themselves, where they are, what the challenges are, and what the biggest hurdles they think they need to overcome. And usually it's people know it already. They they just haven't expressed it. And just the simple factor of talking about it makes them realize, well, actually, I know what I need to do. And sometimes come to the conclusion, well, this extra activity on, I don't know, school's outreach or whatever, is just one thing too many, because every day has only 24 hours for everybody. And if it sometimes appears that some people seem to have more hours in a day, that's that's false. That's a lie. It's just that something else then drops off the table, and you can't do it all. And that's quite normal. I mean, there's nothing to be ashamed about. I'm not sure I did answer your question in that sense, but I think it's very much dependent on everyone's situation. Then there is no answer that fits all.
Then also, because you know the German system, because you, as you said, you went to university in Germany. Maybe you haven't been in the German academic system that much, but I would assume you still know a bit how it works. But you are also very embedded in the British academic system, and of course also know the European system very well. From our perspectives, the different forms of engagement are quite different. So from the German perspective, in the UK, public engagement and outreach and knowledge exchange plays a stronger role, for example, when you apply for research funding. And in Germany, it's now more and more also proposed to include, for example, science communication and outreach as a criterion in funding decisions. How do you see these differences between these academic systems? And do you think German institutions should focus more on what you before called science, like the science plus, and not just the science?
Science plus, whatever name you want to give it. What I particularly like about the UK system, and I'm not going specifically to talk about outreach activities or science communication, but I'm going to talk about the opportunities that young researchers have in the UK. I would argue it's worldwide unique in the sense that very early on after your PhD, one can actually get complete academic freedom. You don't have a professor above you telling you which research direction you need to do, or which lectures you need to take on just to, whatever, fulfill the requirements. Let's put it that way. It's through the availability of these independent research fellowships that immediately catapult young researchers into an almost senior academic position, in a similar way that you then can set up your own research laboratory, drive your own research agenda. And that academic freedom gives people also the freedom of engaging either with the public, with the policymakers, because these people they have the ownership of their time. They can decide how they divide it, whether they do 100% research, whether they want to split it, whether they want to work part-time and do something else on the side. In Germany, I'm not aware that's possible in the same way, even though there are fellowships for young researchers, but I think that academic freedom is not there in the same way. And that impacts on how people act, react, or feel free to explore other avenues besides the research. Having said that, as important as I consider outreach and engaging with policymaking, et cetera, as a scientist, not everybody is made for it. And there are some scientists who are just brilliant scientists, and who are fantastic in their research, and I think they should be left alone to do the research and the big discoveries. Having said that, it doesn't mean that those who engage and do other thousands of other things are not good in their research, but they also have the ability to do other things, or maybe the interest to do other things. And I think if you give people the freedom to do what they're good at and what they enjoy, then it's almost automatic that good things come from that. Whereas if you apply a pattern and say, well, it's important to do outreach, so everybody has to do outreach, you're creating some very awkward situations, and shouldn't call it ill performance, but if you squeeze somebody into a box or into a cage and ask them to perform, it will never be the same exciting show as if you give somebody a stage to just explore and perform and have fun. Because in the end, we're all human beings, and we need to enjoy what we do. If we don't enjoy it, it's rarely that something good comes from it.
Do you also see any disadvantage of this becoming independent in such an early stage of the career as it is in the UK in comparison to Germany?
Well, I was always keen to be independent very early on. At the same time, it comes at the price that after your first postdoc or so, you're given a laboratory space, and that's usually empty. And then you have to fill that laboratory space with equipment and with items that you need to do your research. And that takes quite a lot of time to build and construct and get the research funds on. And it is pressure, yet you have complete freedom to design it yourself. If you are more part of a research infrastructure that is maybe coordinated by a senior professor or something, then it's quite easy to do the research because everything is there and accessible. But you don't have that entire freedom that you would have. So that's a trade-off. You know, there's no perfect answer and perfect solution. It really, everybody has to answer that question for themselves of what they need, what they want, and what they're good at. Me personally, I love to collaborate, but I also like my freedom, and I like to be able to select my collaborators. Doesn't mean that I didn't get on with my PhD advisor. It was a great mentor too.
But talking about the mentoring, the things that you do beyond your core research, I assume you didn't learn that much from your official mentors or in your training, but it was probably more, you know, funding a young academy or being engaged in policy advice, or you already said that then starting to collaborate more with industry. How did you acquire these competencies for these quite intersectoral dialogue sometimes and very different languages, maybe?
Nobody said that I'm competent. Well, in my case, it's learning by doing, and I think it's true for many people, learning by doing. But of course, for example, for the group of chief scientific advisors, I stumbled into that role having been nominated by the Young Academy of Europe and then selected. The first year, I would say, I just sat there in this group of seven, listening to the other six very experienced scientists, to the chair, Wolf Heuer, and the deputy, Pearl Dijkstra. And I literally was just lip reading all the time to understand why they say things, when they say, and how they say them in certain situations. And I'm still learning, and I think everybody is still learning. And what is key is that you admit your weaknesses and that you say when you don't know. Important is to say when you know something, and you need to also be open and transparent enough to say, actually, I have no idea, or I need help. And that's my method. Whenever I don't know, I ask.
What about failure? Because when we look from the outside, then you managed all these different languages and competences quite well. Which role does failure play here?
All the time. It started with my school days and university days when I failed my exams and I had to retake them. I can't remember how many times, but I had to retake them. Failure is an integral part of success. You learn from failure. And what I dislike the most is when you see websites or CVs of people that look amazing. Say, oh my God, how on earth did they manage this? And I again failed another grant application, or I applied for the job and I wasn't invited for interview bear in mind that all these stellar CVs or success stories are built on failures. When you ask people to produce a CV of failures, and there are some out there on the web, you will see that these CVs are much longer than those that display the success stories. So before I got my job, a permanent job, I can't even remember how many interviews I went to, failed, didn't get anywhere. And that's true for everybody. If there's anybody out there and says, well, no, I haven't got any failures, that's a lie. So don't give up.
Never give up. I find this very interesting that you put this so prominently and talking about what you had to learn to, or what you're still learning to, for example, in these policy advice bodies. Do you think this is something that would also make scientific policy advice more effective if policymakers understand this more? And what do you think policymakers need to understand more about science and research to make this relationship more effective?
Policymakers are very bright people. They understand a lot, but they have to act in a constrained environment. There are certain things they just need to get done. And this engagement between scientists and policymakers, that's an exercise where both parties are learning, policymakers as much as the scientists communicating to the policymakers. And what the scientists are often not aware of are these constraints that the policymakers need to act within. For example, in times of crisis, they need to have quick answers, fast answers and solutions to how do we handle, and I don't want to mention the word pandemic, but this is what we're living in. You know, how many masks to order, when to order them, how to get the people vaccinated or not vaccinated, who should get vaccinated first. And if a scientist then comes and says, yeah, well, we need to gather the evidence first, and that takes about 5 years, they don't have time for 5 years. So there's this balance when you do science advice and communicating with policymakers. You want it to be evidence-based, of course, but evidence gathering and using evidence, scientific evidence, to provide advice to policymakers takes time. And it's the science advice under sort of difficult circumstances or science advice in crisis doesn't give you that time to gather all the evidence, or simply the evidence doesn't exist yet because, you know, we don't know how certain things work because we just haven't experienced them yet. And what happens there is that it's the scientist's role then to communicate the level of uncertainty of what is known and what is not known and what is clearly unknowable in these circumstances, that the scientist conveys that to the policymaker, and the policymaker on that basis, together with all the other aspects they need to consider, takes that political decision.
Is this then something we as scientists have to improve or to still to learn? Because when we look, let's discuss about COVID, but let's take climate change, which is the really huge crisis in front of us. I think there's no doubt. To master that crisis on that level of complexity,
yeah.
If you had a wish list, what could we do from our scientific perspective?
If we're honest to ourselves, the real problem is climate change. COVID is terrible. It's horrible. But the real issue is climate change. That's really what we need to deal with. And what scientists need to learn is to communicate the certainties and uncertainties and what they don't know. Because normally when you ask a scientist, or if I ask you, Doris, what are the parameters to create nanoparticles of this size in, I don't know, 20 seconds? You would say, oh, I don't know. I would have to do the experiments and gather the data. I give you a day to do your experiment. And so, one day is not enough. I need at least 1 year, and then I have to do an experimental series, and then I have to recheck, and I need another year and a third year to analyze that data to draw my conclusions. Sometimes that time is not available. And I think scientists need to learn as, you know, what is possible, what is not possible, and to communicate that very clearly. That what answers that you would give in a scientific community don't necessarily work in a policy environment. You can say that this is the best to what I know currently. These are the unknowns. And then the rest is, we just don't know, uncertain.
Do we have this convey also into teaching?
Personally, I think so, yes. I do mention it when I talk about it to my students.
In your opinion, when you give this policy advice, are the current structures well? Do you think they are well established that this could work? Maybe there's a little bit more like in the communicating that needs to be improved, but that the structures in general are appropriate? Or do you think there are some crucial pieces missing in how this all works at the moment?
When you mention structures, what do you mean by structures?
For example, at the European level, the science advice, or maybe in the UK, it works differently than in Germany, how politicians gather the advice from scientists.
Okay, well, I mean, what I can say is there's no answer that fits all. Again, at the European level, there are multiple entities and structures that provide scientific advice. There's a JRC, and I just in this moment forgot the acronym. The Joint Research Center of the Commission, which is a commission institution that conducts research and provides scientific advice. It's, of course, within the commission. Then there's many other bodies. The Group of Chief Scientific Advisors is an independent group, so we're not part of the commission, but we are engaging with the commission to understand what they need. So we provide a different form of advice in the sense that it's independent, it's in collaboration with over 100 European academies and leading scientists in these academies who gather the evidence. And there are many other bodies that provide scientific advice. In the UK, you have a chief scientific advisor. In Germany, you don't have it. You have the Leopoldina. So it's very much the structures as they are grown. There's also this network of the European Science Advisors Forum that meet about once a year to just exchange thoughts and ideas on how to best provide scientific advice. It's an ongoing process that is being shaped at the commission level, but also at the national level. And yeah, it is naturally grown. And the idea is to somehow bring it together, but maybe the all together and basically having one approach to everything may not be the answer, because we have cultural differences. We have culturally different requirements. What is key, I think, is the clear communication and the transparent communication, and to provide pathways and environments where we can share know-how and experience and best practices.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Nicole. So I think if we translate engagement in someone who shapes the world around themselves, then I think you're certainly a highly engaged person, or maybe even an activist. So that's maybe not the word you would use to describe yourself, but let's see. So we are now approaching the end from my point of view, and I think Gisela is with me here. Yes, a very interesting and inspiring conversation. Is there something we did not touch so far and what you would like to address?
I think we touched on everything. I just like to come back to the word activist. I guess we're all activists in some form or the other. Some activists are louder and others are a bit quieter. But in the end, every single person in Germany, in Europe, in the world, shapes the time that we live in. And as long as we believe in what we do and as long as we don't harm others, I think activism is okay.
Thank you very much, Professor Nicole Grobert, for this thought-provoking discussion and your views on research and activism. We really enjoyed gaining these insights from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great pleasure. Hi.